Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with me for a return visit to Writer's Voices is David Gessner. And the book that we're talking about today is the 25th anniversary edition of Return of the Osprey. Now, David is the Keenan Distinguished Professor in Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina in Wilmington. He is the author of 14 books, including the New York Times bestseller, All the Wild That Remains. Welcome back to Writer's Voices, David.
Thank you, Monica. Happy to be here.
So 25th anniversary edition, that's pretty special.
Yeah, they don't stick around that long usually. So
So what is it about this book that made your publisher want to do this?
Well, it was a new publisher, Cornell, and they specialize in bird books, and it's puttered along for 25 years, and it got some great reviews early on, and it became within the birding world a known quantity, but they decided that they wanted to try to put it out again as a celebration, and for me, it's great. It's you know most books last as long as cottage cheese out of the fridge, and so this is a nice thing to have. And I'm really pleased with the foreword, right, by Helen McDonald, and the photo, which is, I hadn't known this guy, Mark Smith, has a picture of an osprey with a fish. And I looked him up and he had 2.2 million Instagram followers. So I just invited him up to the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, to do a talk in which I read the passage I'm going to read for you, but in the background on a big movie screen were his films of diving ospreys. And afterward, people all said, did you guys coordinate this? Did you, when the osprey's lifting out of the water, his picture is, and I said, nope, it was just luck. And it was one of the most fun readings. I'm usually pretty chatty, as you can tell already. But this time
no.
I just decided to do a cold open and walk in the dark and read while his film was up there. It was terrific.
Wow. This picture is pretty amazing. And it definitely illustrates something that you talk about in the book, which is that, most birds of prey that fish, they'll pick up the fish crosswise, and within both talons. But the osprey, then describe what it is that he does,
It's a reversible talon on that back where he's basically holding it like a torpedo in a torpedo bay. So it's aerodynamic. Basically, for listeners who don't know ospreys really, they're raptors. They're the only raptor that gets its meal living solely by diving for fish. They're built and evolved for diving for fish. They've got a black bandit mask, which is kind of like the NFL football players putting eye black underneath so they can stare down from 50 feet up and look into the water. And then they go flying at 40 miles an hour head first. It looks like they're going to plunge in head first. And at the last second, they kick a wheelie and clutch a fish. And that's how they make their living. And to me, that was a large part of the appeal, was the athleticism of the bird.
And they take the fish and they flip it around so that it's, when they're flying with it, the fish is head first.
Yes. They got it all, basically.
Yeah. And it's kind of amazing. I mean, how do they keep from dropping the fish when they're doing that? Because they don't necessarily capture it that way, right?
They can turn it, and that one, I'm looking down at the picture as I speak, that's why I'm hesitating. Yeah. that one front talon is pretty well into the fish at this point.
So they're holding on to it with one claw, basically.
Or a couple
claws.
And they have to be on the lookout for their arch enemy, the bald eagles that come in and try. Ben Franklin thought that bald eagles shouldn't be our national symbol because they're kleptoparasitic, and they come in and bully the osprey and try to take the fish away. So
right, and they eat carrion, which the ospreys the only raptor that doesn't do that, or one of very few?
No. I mean, different raptors do that, but they're just the only ones who are a fish specialist. You know,
okay.
So pelicans dive for fish and gannets, and you know.
Yeah, didn't Ben Franklin want the turkey?
Correct. Yes.
And wild turkeys are actually pretty amazing birds too. Have you ever written about them?
I've written a little because, you know, they've come back so much to New England and down here as well, North Carolina.
So, you know, reading your notes, your update, your preface to the 25th anniversary edition, you mentioned your reluctance to write this book in the beginning because you didn't want to be pigeonholed as
yes.
a bird writer.
Good phrase. yeah, that's kind of the origin story of the book. I'd worked in my 20s writing novels. I had didn't know any writers. My parents weren't. I had no clue. And so I just set to writing these novels and sending them out foolishly to large presses, assuming that my genius would be recognized and I'd be swooped up. That did not happen. My first book that was published in my 30s was a memoir about my dad, who was dying of lung cancer. But it was also a celebration of Cape Cod. The irony being that I wrote it once I'd moved to Colorado. When that book came out, I was hailed as a nature writer, which I never expected to be. I thought I was a writer. Then, because the book came out, I moved back to Cape Cod and immediately turned around and wrote a book about loving Colorado. So this is geographic confusion, right? And basically, I was once again called a nature writer. So I wrote an essay called Sick of Nature, which was my declaration of independence from the nature writing, you know, genre. And the strange thing was, this editor, Antonio Fusco, read it, and she loved the piece, but in it I described birds, and she especially loved birds, so here she comes to me and calls me up and asks me to do a nature book. So I'm pretty much like, okay, I'll do it, you know, because she also said, I will give you an advance. And that advance was a life changer for me. It wasn't much money, and it was probably $10,000 total, but it allowed me to quit my job and just write for the first time, really.
When you're writing this book, it sounds like you're going to be in Cape Cod forever.
Yes, we can get to that. But I mean, basically, she called up and said, you write beautifully about birds. I'd like you to do a book about birds. And I was like, okay, well, I don't want to do a book about a robin or a semi-palmated plover or, you know, or sparrow. And then I remembered, you know, I'd spent a lot of time on Cape Cod as a kid and never seen ospreys because they'd been wiped out by DDT. So here I am coming back as a, you know, in my late 30s with my wife, and they're everywhere. They're at the end of our jetty. And I'm like, that I can do a book about, I told her. And I thought, they're returning from DDT. I was recovering from a bout with testicular cancer. It seemed great. And so I took the money from the advance, quit my job, bought a Bushmaster a Bushnell Space Master telescope. And I went out to the marshes and watched four nests in mid-March, which is when these birds would return to Cape Cod from South America. And also coincidentally was my birthday, March 15th. So I started watching and wasn't very good at it at first, you know, kind of a bumbler. I didn't know ospreys from gulls basically, but, you know, I had this mentor who was kind of my Obi-Wan Kenobi, Alan Poole. And he said to me, you've got to be patient. You've got to learn to live on osprey time. I was bad at living at osprey time at first. You know, I sat out there thinking an hour had passed and looked down at my watch and it was 7 minutes. So, but the process, you know, gradually I got better. And I also got better at writing about them too.
So would you take notes while you were watching them?
Well, I don't think, is this just, do people just hear this or do they see this?
They just hear it. Yeah.
Well, you can at least see this giant journal that I kept along with the telescope out there. And I really didn't, it was a really interesting writing moment for me. You know, I'd written two smaller books that were mostly books of essays. And here I knew I couldn't start the book until the Ospreys flew south in September. So I just gathered stuff in this journal, and I didn't have any rules. I'd do drawings of the Ospreys at the nest. I'd do like physical notes. I drew the nest they were in. You know, a lot of Ospreys before 30 years ago, most Ospreys would nest in dead trees. Now they nest often on human platforms that are built for them because we don't have as many dead trees. And I would draw the nests. And one thing that drew me to Ospreys from the beginning, other than their athleticism, was that they were slobs. And I've always been slobbed. In fact, as a writer, I have this aesthetic of kind of messiness, which Helen MacDonald mentions a little in the foreword. I like to put a lot of different things in. I don't like to be stuck in one genre. So these big nests had like fishing line in them and Easter tinsel and boat rope. And I'm looking at your desk. They also had on one of the nests, a naked Barbie doll jammed into them. So yours isn't naked, but you know.
No, mine is not. Mine is actually that's the original outfit that the original Barbie came in.
Yes.
It's well, this the black and the white striped swimsuit.
This wasn't the original one and it had no outfit, but it was, you know, it was just an example of this, you know, this athletic, but kind of, my dad used to call me Dirty Dave. So I had empathy with their messiness. I spilled a lot. Yeah, it was a little mean. But they also are gregarious birds. So, and not super private. So I could watch as they rebuilt the nest and the male would bring sticks in and the female would decide if they were good enough and if not, throw it over and go get another one, she'd say. I watched them incubate the eggs and I watched that process and I slowly got better at living on osprey time and at learning ospreys. And of course, one of the great moments was when the young were born and their little reptilian heads peeked up over the edge of the nest. And this thing that I loved was the male would bring back a fish. Sometimes the female would, but mostly the male. The female would rip it apart savagely, you know, and then delicately place it in the maw of the nestlings. And I love that marriage of the savage and the delicate. And it really became kind of a guiding metaphor for the year.
Now, why, you said you knew that you couldn't start writing until the ospreys had flown south for the winter. Why was that?
I wanted to tell the full story of them finding home and nesting and then the birds fledging and leaving. And so I felt like it would be, you know, I could have told it, I guess, in just present tense as, you know, journal form as it was happening. Mm-hmm. But instead I kept that journal and as well as those notes of trying to observe as deeply as I could what was going on. I also was making little outlines of what the chapters might look like. I was thinking of, you know, and at night, of course, I was reading everything about ospreys. So it was like it's been helpful for me in the 10 books or so since, or 11 books since, this knowing how much obsession is an aid to these things, you know? And so, you know, and, you know, there's that, I think I quoted it last time I was on here. I probably did because I can't stop quoting it, but the John Muir line about when you pick up one thing, you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. So I, reading about ospreys, I'm suddenly going, oh my God, they were there at the beginning of environmental law, really at the beginning of real modern environmentalism, because, you know, the story is basically that a small group of Long Islanders read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and decided to fight back against the local mosquito commission in the 60s that was spraying DDT, that was killing the insects, but then killing the fish that the insects were eating. And the ospreys would then at the top of the food chain eat the fish. And it did this horrible thing where it thinned their eggs. So when they went to incubate and sit on them, they would crush their own young. So these guys were pissed off, this local environmental group, and they sued, and they won. And soon enough, DDT was outlawed there, but then in a couple states. And their motto was, they became the Environmental Defense Fund, and their motto was sue the bastards. And they ended up, you know, helping DDT be outlawed nationally by the EPA in 1972. So I thought it was amazing that, you know, I'd gotten this Osprey story, but it was connected to all these other things, which always happens when you're writing a book, right? You know, it's like, it's crazy.
You know, I wonder if that could even, if we would even be successful today in this political climate with banning something that was proven to be so harmful.
Not at the moment, but there are actually, I'll talk about that. There's a current threat and some glimmers of hope at the moment about that. And glimmers of hope aren't easy to come by these days. So,
we'd love to hear some glimmers of hope.
Yeah. I'll work back around to that.
So you chose four different nests to watch. And why those four?
Well, one was right across from my house. And a big theme of the book was finding home. And I was lucky enough to be basically squatting in my parents' house on Cape Cod. And one was right above, below my dad's gravesite. My dad had died, you know, a couple of years before. And two were like one near the beach and one on the marsh. So there was variety there, you know, and I got, you know, different stories happened at different places. Like there was a siblicide at one of the nests, which is, you know, because there were four nestlings and the three wanted to survive and the runt was bullied out of getting fish, even though the mother tried. And so, so each nest provided its own story, basically.
But you picked those out kind of ahead of time, or were you watching more and then narrowed it down?
No, I had been watching, obviously, the one across from my house. Mm-hmm. I would have done the one at the end of the jetty, but that wasn't, you know, sometimes these things don't take. I knew I wanted to watch one near my dad's grave. And then the other two, I forget how I found them, but no, I didn't, I didn't winnow it down. I just had those four. Yeah.
And did you sort of make a circle every day, or how did that work?
I made a circle every day. I spent a lot of time out there, bored at first, but then getting more into it. I'd had the good fortune of taking a class as a grad student with Linda Hogan, the Native American fiction writer, poet, nonfiction writer, a great teacher. And she had given our class an assignment to go out and watch an animal and just watch it for a month and take notes. And I'd done that with a great blue heron, did a lot of drawings of it. I used to draw a lot. And that was kind of my early introduction to this. And now suddenly I was doing it on a large scale. And of course, Cape Cod changes in the summer. All of a sudden, it goes from being kind of a rural place to being overcrowded. So, you know, and I'm worrying about the birds. And I mean, I got so into the birds that I remember, I think I wrote about this, maybe in the new foreword too, where I was walking out to one of the nests on the marsh. And somebody was coming back all excited, his eyes lit up. And I wanted to say, have you found Osprey too? You know, like kind of a religious. And then there's a, you know, and the progression of the book, because I knew like, oh, this is more like writerly. So I'm taking these notes, but I'm also thinking about what this book's going to look like. There'd already been a scientific book on ospreys by Alan Poole, the guy I mentioned. So why was mine going to be interesting? If it's just technical facts about an osprey, it's going to bore people to death, right? As a narrative. So I kind of realized that I was the central character in the sense that I was a beginner, you know, kind of a stand-in for anyone reading who would gradually learn. So in terms of integrating the research, I'd actually have myself, you know, by the wood stove late at night reading and then integrate the research, which I work with my grad students on all the time. How do you make it smooth where it's not like a sudden lurch from personal narrative to research, right? So I realized that, and I did get more and more obsessed. So I could include scenes like near the end where I went up to the local fish market and got a fish and some pliers. And I was like trying to feel, you know, I mentioned that the female would sometimes rip it apart with her bill. With the pliers, I tried to feel what it was like. And my wife claims, you know, I was on our back deck. She claims I was wearing a loincloth while I was doing that, but I don't own a loincloth. So I'm pretty sure it was a bathing suit, you know, like that I was wearing. But, you know, so it was about, and she kind of rolled her eyes and was like, this is, you know, enough is enough, kind of. You're not actually an osprey. Yeah. But that's fun. That's part of the fun of these, you know, of these nonfiction adventures, is to just throw yourself into them.
Well, I really enjoy reading nonfiction that does include that personal element, you know, kind of some element of memoir along and kind of linking the subject that you're writing about with literature and history and politics and all sorts of different things. But I wanted to ask you, interestingly enough, I just read an essay just the other day that talked about how women writers, if they're writing about a serious nonfiction subject and have put any element of memoir in, all of a sudden it's characterized as a memoir. And the rest of it is, you know, they're ignored as, you know, as a serious writer, basically. What do you think about that?
I could do a whole podcast on just that subject. And I could start with the fact that female, male, whatever, New York publishing is currently like, you know, memoir is a dirty word. And it's for the same reason, you know, it's like, it's always been, oh, you're too personal. And of course, women writers are going to get hit harder than that. And what it leads to, in my opinion, are these nonfiction books about animals, say, or whatever, that are boring. I'm not going to read just, and it's really crazy. I mean, you know, because I've dealt a lot with this. I've dealt with publishers saying there's too much David Gessner in there. And I'm like, well, you know, there's a spectrum. There's, if you think about it, like a John McPhee on one end and say Edward Abbey or Dillard on the other. And I prefer the more personal end. And I think that's true. It's true for female writers, but it's also to some extent true to male. Like they're like, oh, this is, you know, too soft, and it's not. And what you get is environmental books where somebody just, you know, like travels from place to place and talks to a scientist and says, you know, Dr. Reynolds said, right? And okay, that's great. I like that stuff. And then I want to hear about you and what it means to your life. I mean, this book for me was about how ospreys, which I learned about, changed my life. I mean, they changed my life by making me more of an observer, making me, you know, being able to watch and notice, but also like thinking about home, even though, as you pointed out, there's kind of an ironic twist to that in the end. But so, yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree. I'd like to read that essay, actually.
Okay, I will send it to you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry to rant, but I'll tell you what.
That's okay.
I mean, I'm just, you know, it's like, who are these people who don't write personal stuff in their books?
I know.
And also, that's what I meant kind of by the aesthetic of messiness, which Helen MacDonald nicely points out in there. In the book, their personal stories next to science, next to jokes, next to, you know, because that's the fun of it to me, you know. And I always I remember the Monty Python kind of, you know, high, low, where you're, you know, where you're looking up at the stars and waxing philosophic and you step in dog shit. You know, to me that I like having the mix of those things.
And that's what I like as a reader too. And even be more than, I wouldn't say I read very many straight memoir,
right?
Because I don't find that all that interesting either, but it's the combination that I really like. Yeah. Right.
I agree.
Yeah. But speaking of putting yourself in your book, you write about the illustrations that you're doing, but there aren't any of them in the book. I would have loved to have seen some of your illustrations.
Yeah. Well, you know, my first book, my background was as a cartoonist, a political cartoonist. So my first book, it was the first time I ever drew straight. Like I actually drew, and I don't know. I just felt like I'm better with words than pictures these days. So But I have thought about, I've actually thought about reaching out to Mark Smith, who did the cover, about doing, kind of an illustrated current book on ospreys.
Oh, yeah. That sounds lovely. So David, before we have you read, you're talking a little bit about the current environmental situation, and I wanted to get into that a little bit. Got something you want to share about that?
Yes. This was certainly not planned to coincide with the book coming out. But a few months ago, people started reaching out to me about a new osprey crisis. You know, during those bad old days of DDT, the numbers, for instance, in Massachusetts in 1970, there were only 10 nests. You know, now there are hundreds, right? So it's been one of the most hopeful environmental stories. But like many things these days, it's taken a little downturn lately in that the new culprit isn't a chemical. It's the overfishing, the industrial fishing of menhaden, the fish that ospreys most depend on. And that happens, there's only one state on the East Coast that allows that, and it's Virginia. And there's one fishery, there's one company, Omega Protein, that take millions of tons of menhaden. And what that has led to in the Chesapeake Bay is ospreys starving, the osprey numbers going back to the bad old days of DDT, plummeting numbers after, this burgeoning hopeful story. And because, what starts in Virginia doesn't stay in Virginia. It affects Delaware, Maryland. Now there's that fishing going on beyond international lines in southern New Jersey. And we're even getting reports from Connecticut and Massachusetts that the numbers are falling. So the good news is people are pissed off and people are fighting back against this and trying to outlaw that fishing in Maryland. And I mentioned there was glimmers of hope. One of the interesting things is this is not just affecting ospreys, it's affecting stripers and bluefish and other sports fish. So you have this union kind of embodied in Teddy Roosevelt, from the old days, where you have outdoorsmen, fishermen, hunters, uniting with environmentalists and birders and coming together. So there are actually, there's actually a video of people in MAGA hats fighting against, the osprey. So it's this rare kind of reaching across the aisle. And I got to say that union, is one of those hopeful things. And I'll explain, like with the Big Beautiful Bill, the assault on Western public lands got kicked out of there in part because you had organizations like Meat Eaters and, hunting and fishing organizations teaming up with the Sierra Club and environmental organizations. So that's like old school conservatism. And it used to be a big part of why we saved lands. So I see this in Louisiana, where the fishermen who probably all voted for Trump are also environmentalists by way of the oil spills and things. So to me, that's a little bit of a, in a dark time, that's a little ray of light.
And when did conservatism become anti-conservation? That's what I'd like to know, and
it's
how
crazy. It's crazy.
It is because those words, it shouldn't be that way. And I talk, I think about my father, who's been gone for a long time, but he was definitely politically conservative, but he was very much an environmentalist, was into organic agriculture.
Right.
He would find a home in the Republican Party today.
I wrote a book called The Tarball Chronicles. I went down during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, I worked for the National Resource Defense Council and was down there for the summer. And my main character in that book, Ryan Lambert, is, you know, a big old hunting and fishing guide who teased me and would call Obama your president, you know, like, and politically we were on opposite ends, but we had the land in common, and the land was oiled, and the marshes were oiled, and the water was oiled. So he was a great fighter for, you know, against BP. So yeah, there can be a union there, which is hopeful, I think.
You know, you talk a little bit of it in the book about migration routes, and also how development, you know, destroying habitat and some of these animals and birds and everything, who, if they can't come back to where they've always come, they don't know where to go.
Exactly. And stopover points, like I just mentioned Louisiana, you know, they know as they're traveling where they're going to be able to eat, when they're going to be able to rest. And when that changes, not to mention the timing of the year changing because of climate change, it's not just that they don't, you know, they leave earlier or later, it's the food they are going to eat isn't there at the time they are usually there. So it's like the world's clock is off. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just read an article about some African tribes people who are trying to, I think Marriott is developing something right in the path of the great animal, the great migration routes in Africa. And these tribes people are trying to stop it, and the courts are shutting them down, or like a gag order was issued on the tribes people.
Yeah.
That's just appalling, because we don't know what the unintended consequences are of disturbing the natural rhythms that much.
Well, also, this took billions of years to be perfected, the timing of these things and the migration. And then in a few years, trying to destroy it.
Yeah.
Anyway, we could get a lot darker.
We can. Yeah. Okay. Now, I just did look that up, and AI is saying that that there's no evidence of a gag order related to that. I may have misspoken, but it's something I saw on a social media thing, which you always have to double check. You don't know for sure what's true. So let's talk a little.
If you want to.
Yeah. Let's move on to, we were going to do a reading, and but you had a few more comments to make about memoir.
Well, I just think that, it's a very, from the beginning, it was a disrespect to genre. And I'll tell you a story that isn't going to shine my father in a favorable light. But during my 20s, when I wasn't publishing and I wasn't sure what to do, you know, I had more than one crisis. And I generally approached my mom, who was easy to talk to and not my kind of stern businessman dad. But one time where I was just overwhelmed, I started to tell him about, you know, what it was like to, you know, to be doing this thing that I didn't know if it was right. And I wasn't making much money because I was working as a carpenter's apprentice or in a bookstore. And I got up the nerve and I told him this. And then there was a long pause. And he said, "Do you realize how many times you've said the word I in the last 10 minutes? And to me, that's comparable to these anti-memoirist critics. You know, it's always like, oh, they're so, these memoirs are using any memoir in a piece, you know, oh, they're so sloppy and personal and self-reflexive. Well, if it can be done poorly, certainly.
Yes.
Yeah. But it can be done well too. You know, I think of Thoreau and Walden when he said, "I wouldn't write about myself if there were anyone else I knew as well." you can do it like any genre, you can do it well.
Yes. And, you know, I read if I'm reading nonfiction in particular, but even fiction to some extent, I read for the connection. to people that I will probably never meet, although I'm meeting a whole lot more authors than probably anybody else does, since I've done like 700 of these interviews.
Wow.
Yeah. But still, it's, you know, as a natural introvert, it's actually an easier way for me to feel a connection with somebody.
Yeah.
By reading what they've written.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so David, let's hear a bit of Return of the Osprey. Osprey. I notice you, it's more Osprey,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it's okay to say, it's more correct to say Spray, yeah.
Okay.
Ospreys are the only raptors that dive fully into the water to catch their prey. Try to imagine the physical sensation. To skim across the sky above the ocean, peering down with eyes that can see into the shallows from 40, 60, even 100 feet up. To catch a glint or the shadow of a movement and know it to be a fish, the one thing that keeps you alive. To hover, adjust, beating your wings so that you stay in place like a giant kingfisher or hummingbird. Then to dive, to commit, to tuck with folded wings and plunge downward at over 40 miles an hour while still keeping your eyes on the prey, calculating its size and movement. To adjust in midair, redirecting, considering even the refraction of the fish's image in the water before pulling in your wings and diving again. And then at the last second before hitting the water, to throw your wings back and your talons forward, striking feet first. To plunge in, splash, immerse, and make contact at the same time, trapping, piercing, clutching a slippery, scaled, cold-blooded creature. Now imagine what comes next, securing the fish, aided by the sharp, horny scales on the pads beneath your toes. For a moment, being out of your element and in your prey's, feeling wet, awkward, ungainly. Then lifting off from the water with a great thrust of exertion, soaked and heavy, hefting an animal that may weigh half of what you do. Beating your wings furiously and rising, shaking the water off like a wet dog, already using your reversible outer talon to adjust the squirming fish, turning the fish so that it faces forward to reduce drag, as you lift into the air triumphant, or at least successful, shaking off silvery flecks of spray. To even imagine a dive is to get excited. What a bold way to live. To find one thing you do well and then stake your life on it. It's as simple and direct as passion. It is passion. Peter Matheson wrote, "Simplicity is the whole secret of well-being." If so, the ospreys have got it figured out. It isn't hard to picture a band of primitive osprey tribesmen watching the birds and learning from them. One thing they might have learned, and one thing that appeals to me, is how the osprey's dive weds calculated patience to wild aggression. He who hesitates is smart, at least if when he finally commits, he commits fully. For the osprey, the hesitation is as important as the dive. The birds have a remarkable success rate, some catching well over 50% of what they dive for. Like humans, athleticism varies. A few particularly adept birds catch close to 90%. And this is due in good part to the pre-dive patience, the search for the right target. This careful adjustment will often carry over into the dive itself. After the bird has tucked its wings and dropped down 30 feet, it may pause and readjust, and may repeat this a time or two again, as if descending imaginary stairs. But while the pre-dive ritual demands control and calculation, the plunge itself is about the opposite of control. It is a moment of full commitment, of abandon, and finally, of immersion. But now a confession. So far, I've witnessed dives only in my imagination. Despite having spent the past 2 months roaming the marsh, and the last 2 years walking the beach, I've never seen an osprey dive. This is a fairly major failing for a budding ospreyologist. By all accounts, the dive is the pinnacle of osprey artistry. It's also how the birds survive. An osprey is built for fishing, and over the last 15 million years or so, has been perfectly honed by evolution to get its food solely by diving from the sky. While most raptors hunt a variety of prey and in a variety of ways, ospreys eat fish almost exclusively. Despite the nearly constant vocalizations of the quivet female to her mate, one question she never asks is, what's for dinner? As I follow the birds, for the first time in my life, I'm taking what I know about nature, about wind and water, weather and animals, and trying to put this knowledge to use to achieve something. Though what I'm mainly finding out is that I don't know much. There are times when I feel perfectly content, consumed with the process of hunting for the hunt, fishing for fishing. There's a primitive satisfaction in reducing life to one goal, and I sometimes remember Alan Poole's speculation about a Neanderthal or Cro-Magnon osprey people. Think of the raw simplicity of a hunter's life. Get food as a commandment is thrillingly reductive. If there is anxiety about the task, at least it's specific anxiety. To track, to hunt, means to focus on one thing, the prey. But to focus well, the whole world must be taken into account. My own commandment over the last weeks has been only a little more complex than primitive man's. Mine is see bird dive. Alan Poole relates a missionary story of how a Bolivian Indian slipped a warm bone from an osprey under the skin of his arms, apparently in hopes of absorbing hawk-like skills at hunting. That seems a little drastic, but it might be worth slipping a bone under my forearm, at least if it instills an enlivened sense of purpose. As it is, I'm not above sniffing the air or playing my hunches. One thing I hope for is that I'll soon have osprey dreams. I fully expect to, not out of any mystical alliance, but because osprey is what I do all day. It's been my experience that dreams steal from life, particularly life's more exciting parts. When I played Ultimate Frisbee in college, I'd sometimes spend the better part of the night skying or diving after discs. In The Snow Leopard, Peter Matheson writes about his young son's artwork, ecstasy is identity with all existence, and ecstasy showed in his bright paintings, like the hunter who became the deer he drew on the cave wall. There was no self to separate him from the bird or flower. This sentence may also be less mystical than it sounds, more practical and obvious. To be good hunters, we must look at what we're aiming at, seeing and becoming what we stalk.
Thank you, David. That's from the chapter Fishing in Return of the Osprey. Ultimate Frisbee, that was quite another obsession for you, I understand.
Yeah, I wrote a memoir called Ultimate Glory, and it was about it's funny because as I read that passage 25 years ago when the book came out, and a student came up afterward and said, I think your book is as much about writing as it is about ospreys, because as they obsessed with fish, so I was obsessed with making books. Ultimate in a way was, which I played, for 20 years, was also metaphorically like writing, because it was to throw your whole self into this thing that other people considered ridiculous. They were like a Frisbee, and I was like, yeah, we train and we take it seriously. So it's kind of about the energy that you put into a pursuit rather than what the world thinks of it.
So Ultimate Frisbee is pretty popular here in Fairfield, Iowa, too, or at least it used to be. And I was at one point playing a lot of volleyball, which is another one of these sports that nobody really knew about. And most of the people that I played volleyball with also played Ultimate. So I decided to try Ultimate one day. Now, this was probably 25 years ago. But most of the players were younger than me, and most of them were men. But I went out, I tried to play one time, and every time that I flicked the Frisbee, it wouldn't go where I wanted it to go at all. I was really, really, really bad. Mm-hmm. Well, it turned out I had a bone tumor in my hand that I discovered not long after that, had to have bone surgery, and that was why my wrist wouldn't work.
Wow. Well, that relates a little bit to this because, the reason I found out I had testicular cancer was because I was playing pickup basketball and I was kneed and the pain didn't go away. So, I mean, a lot of this book is also about like kind of coming back to life and, and reclaim, I was decent athlete and that was a big part of like getting in shape after being sick was a big part of it. But I did say before that there was an ironic twist, and that's the fact that the book ends with me saying, basically, I will stay forever on Cape Cod. And that's how I got my job down here in North Carolina. They read Return of the Osprey and invited me down for an interview. And at that moment in time, my wife was pregnant for the first time. And I'd gone, my whole life not really having a real job, and suddenly health insurance and a salary seemed like a good idea. And then when I moved down here, I hadn't realized at first that their mascot was the Osprey. I've been here for 20 years now, and not long after I got here, there's a big statue of an Osprey that some frat guys had hacksawed off, and they ended up bringing it back to their dorm, and it was caught. So 2 months after I was here, they had a ceremony where they rewelded the Osprey statue, and they asked me to come read from Return of the Osprey as part of the
Oh,
ceremony.
for heaven's sakes.
So, it was all crazily tied together.
So, any regrets about leaving Cape Cod and taking a day job?
For a while, yes. But my daughter grew up here. She's a senior at NYU right now, but she kind of defined herself as a beach person. We're on the coast. We've got lots of birds. And I've really loved, we're in a creative writing department. And as you know, may know, most creative writing is within an English department. We're separate. There are 17 writers on this hallway. Clyde Edgerton was kind of my hero when I got here, a great Southern novelist. And so it's been a good, yes, regrets. But I get back there a lot. I was just there the last week of October.
Do you, does your family still own the house?
No, my mom, we sold it. So when she went into assisted living, and of course, like the writer I am, we sold it at the bottom of the market, and what we worth 10 times that now. So, but we
Oh.
needed to do it at the time.
Oh,
So,
for heaven's sakes. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of my luck with real estate too.
Yes.
So, how many nests, what percentage of nests fail? And it seems like the birds don't even realize that it's not working for a long time, that they keep trying and trying and trying. And when do they finally decide, oops, I don't have to keep doing this?
Well, the answer is it depends, and this current tragedy has really highlighted that. Colonial Beach, Virginia, I believe it is. Or is it Colonial Beach? You know what? I think it's Virginia. Somebody can call in and correct us. But I was there getting a tour of their osprey nest, and they'd only had usually they have hundreds of successful fledglings, and they'd had single figures this year because of the menhaden problem. And what happens is ospreys regulate when they're not getting enough nourishment. They lay a clutch of one or two eggs instead of three or four. But even those were failing. And sometimes it's obvious, like this one nest in Colonial Beach was, clearly they weren't getting enough food. And then they had a rainstorm in which both of the ospreys left, and crows came in and killed the young. So, it's a sad and frustrating thing, to see. And I'm hoping that turns around.
When the nests fail, is it usually that they laid an egg but it just didn't hatch, or is it that they didn't even lay an egg,
Both.
or both?
Both.
Okay,
Yeah.
yeah. And I'm assuming the maybe younger. How long do ospreys live?
They can live into their late 20s, but out in the wild, you if you're making that huge trip, you know, I did a follow-up book to this where I followed the migration because I was on the move. I figured I'd, you know, I went to Cuba and Venezuela, and, you know, there's hunting in South America where they could be shot. There's all sorts, you know, there are treacherous water crossings. I mean, a really interesting thing is with eagles and hawks, they're moving more toward Mexico, but ospreys, being water lovers, hopscotch through the Caribbean. And I went illegally into Cuba and I watched a whole like clouds of ospreys coming through the mountains there. But yeah, it's a dangerous thing to do to travel that far every year. Wow.
Do other raptors live that long?
I don't know, is my honest answer. Yeah. And, you know, and they don't all live that long. I mean, that's
right.
That's,
right. But have that type of lifespan. I'm thinking that probably younger mates maybe are more likely to have a failed nest. And then maybe the very oldest ones too, is it sort of like human beings that there's an ideal time that they're most likely to be successful at procreating.
They get better at fishing, you know.
And I found it interesting that they don't necessarily migrate in flocks.
No, in fact, the really interesting is the adults take off, and often the fledglings find their way, you know, instinctively with their internal compass, find their way south and then find their way back. So, something's going on there.
That is amazing. So when you did sit down to write this book after the ospreys had left and gone south, you said you by that point had a pretty good idea of what the structure would be?
I did. And actually that's one thing I'm glad you brought up, because I mentioned how I was taking notes and kind of letting it build and build and build. And, you know, and I had several journals, and I'd started to kind of cross index them. But when I finally started to write it, I wrote pretty much the book in a month. There wasn't a lot of sleeping. Like in October into November, I just because it had, and that's something that has kind of stayed with me, is this wait, go, right? Now, of course I went back and my editor sent back notes. I revised it over the next, you know, 6 months. But really the thrust of it was a month of just fairly crazed writing, you know?
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
It was fun.
I bet.
I don't know if I could do that now. I don't know if I have the energy. Yeah.
And it's basically kind of chronological in terms of that time period of watching them.
That's right.
But how did you decide, like, What else to include? Because there's a lot of asides, put it that way. There's a lot of kind of departures from the flow of the story. Were there things that you tried to put in and then couldn't, and other things that?
I mean, I wanted the present tense narrative to be for us to move through the year. One thing I learned during that year was phenology. You know, like when things bud, and when there was a great moment late in that year when I was walking the beach and I looked out at the rocks on Cape Cod Bay, and I was like, the seal should be back soon. I thought that. I went and told my wife, and the next day the seals were back, and I felt like I'd gotten a raise at work or something. I was like, sorry. Because, you know, I had internalized kind of the turn of the year in a way. So I wanted that feel. And I'd always written a lot. I don't do it as much now. I'd always written in the present tense because I, you know, that vivid kind of nature description. But from there, of course, I was going off into the speculative sense and the past tense and the present, you know, and the future tense somewhat. So those were the tangents. And, you know, tangents are basically the lifeblood of an essayist. You know, we're all about tangents. Montaigne got us started. So, you know. Pretty good.
There's a couple of lines that when I read them were like, really struck me. And so I'm just going to share those. One is on page 6, where you're talking about, you mentioned before the, you know, when you were in Cape Cod, you're writing about Colorado. When you're in Colorado, you're writing about Cape Cod. Or so you say, back in Colorado, of course, was where our thoughts often strayed to a front range filled with friends and belongings and joint memories that become more paradisical with each passing second. Yeah. So I love that, the idea that we sometimes tend to idealize.
That's right.
The past or what we don't have yeah. anymore. Yeah.
Well, I think that too, one of the things the book is about is it's about home, but it's also about geographic uncertainty, right? And I think in the nature writing genre, historically, with Thoreau and to the up till Wendell Berry in Kentucky, we generally think of a writer associated with one place, you know? And in fact, Wendell Berry makes that explicit by talking about marrying his place, his home in Kentucky. Well, I found myself loving multiple places. In fact, I wrote an essay for High Country News called A Polygamous Place, where I said, I'm not married to one, and it's not against the law to have multiple places you love. So, and that's to this day, you know, Cape Cod, Colorado, and now North Carolina, little Utah and Louisiana thrown in, you know, I find it hard to fully say this is my one place on earth. And that's kind of how the book, you know, that's what the next book about the migration is really about, how to be in movement.
One of the other lines is further on in the book, and you write that one of Thoreau's less extreme lessons was that you can experience something profound in the natural world without going to the Himalayas, that you can find everything you need in your own backyard. In other words, you don't need to live with grizzlies or gorillas to live deeply. And this is the part I really like. We need to love the near with the same excitement that we love the exotic.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I often think about that because I spend most of my time in Iowa. And Iowa doesn't have a reputation of having a lot of natural beauty, but it does. It's very beautiful. It's just that the beauty is often more subtle. And I've traveled all around the world, and there's many places that I love and want to go back and see myself living. And some of them have maybe much more in your face beauty.
Well, I just did a lot of traveling this fall, and I was out west and in Utah and Colorado, and I was there at a perfect time where the aspen were like blazing yellow. But I still like Cape Cod at that time of year, where it's not as showy, it's more of a purple, you know, clarifying Cape light. In fact, the only other place I remember, I was on a trip to Europe, and my stopover was in Iceland. And I've never walked around Iceland, but just from the airport, I looked out and I thought, ah, home. This reminds me of the Cape, you know, just that kind of, so non-showy, but just still riveting and vibrant natural world.
And I will say that Iowa has some of the most beautiful sunsets I have seen anywhere. And I have gone to the Greek islands where people come in boats just to watch the sunset, you know, on right. the tip of Ia. And it is a gorgeous sunset. The sun sinks into the ocean, but we have just as vibrant colors here. We always do close with a quote, and I pulled one from that you had in the book at the heading of the chapter, Living by Water. And I would like maybe a little bit of context for this quote from Melville, from Moby Dick. Yes, as everyone knows, meditation and water are wedded forever.
Melville always thought was that, you know, and I think is true too. You know, water is just such a stimulating thing for the creative process and the thought process. The interesting thing, of course, is that Melville is writing Moby Dick, landlocked in western Massachusetts. What he's really looking out his window at is the highest mountain in Massachusetts, Mount Greylock. In winter, it's white. So that's his whale that he's looking out at.
Wow.
But while the book is at sea, and you know, obviously he spent much time at sea, it's written in inland. So it's kind of, it's a little like writing a book about Cape Cod and Colorado when Colorado won Cape Cod.
Well, David, thank you. Thank you so much for being with us today on Writers' Voices.
And thank you,
we'll
Monica.
See you all next week.
Thank you.